Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 20th, 2006. Our session today is entitled The Trouble with Absence. Our presenter is Fred Niedner. Session number NIF 2006-7. Let's listen in.
Yeah, welcome again this morning to Bible study. Once again, I'm Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana, and we're doing a series mostly on the New Testament Gospels, asking each one of them how they answer the question, to which I am with you always is the answer, at least in Matthew. But we're talking about the presence of God, and as I said yesterday, for those of you who were here yesterday, I always begin with something that's hilarity slash practical. Something that you might use in case nothing else that happens is useful, and something that contains alleged hilarity in case it doesn't happen naturally. And so I'm reusing the same things that I did last week, so apologies to those of you who were here. But today I thought I would give you some answers. Back in my day job at home, I try to teach students that one of the most important parts of an education is learning to ask the best questions and figuring out which really are the most helpful and the largest questions. But today I'm going to give you answers instead of questions. We do this at baccalaureate. I'm just kidding. So the first answer is the egg. Although we debated that hotly up there at the picnic table the other evening over pizza, there are still some people who think the answer is the chicken. It's the egg. And the second answer is none. If angels did want to show off, they would dance on the point end. But the truth is, angels are not allowed to dance.
They're losers.
Do all their mission coming.
You already know that. If you're too young to know that, ask your parents.
I'm a parent.
Yeah. And the last answer is no. God did not create the world in 6 days. God fooled around for 6 days and pulled an all-nighter. That has to be the answer in an academic
Absolutely.
Because it's the only way anything gets done, whether it's among the students or the faculty. Well, yes. We didn't quite finish what was in my notes to finish, and I want to revisit a little bit of what I wished to do yesterday before we get to Mark's Gospel, which will be the primary agenda. And I'll do this partly because it allows me to tell a story that I want to tell. The bulletin board on the kiosk said that we would be looking at Exodus 33. Today, there's a very rich portion of the book of Exodus in chapters 32 to 34 that have as their theme there in the wilderness portion of the history of the people of Israel, the presence and or the absence of God. And actually, whether or not God will go with the people through the wilderness is the big question. There in Exodus 32 and following. And so this is just a glimpse at the way the Hebrew Bible answers our question, where is God and what is God doing? The sequence starts with the golden calf story, and I suppose it might be cheating to go into that a whole lot today, because I taught this story last year up at Holden, and so we don't want to repeat too much up here. But you'll remember yesterday I told you how God had said to Moses in both the call story of Exodus 3 as well as in Exodus 7, when you answer the question, who is the God that sent you? The answer is, I am, which we saw as a nice little joke, but that also, you will be as God to Pharaoh. And sure enough, when the people later on, partway through the story, experience the absence of Moses, he's been gone for 40 days and 40 nights, and they go to Aaron and they say, this Moses man who led us up here, he is gone. What are we going to do now? And their response is to make, well, they make golden calves for themselves, or a golden calf for themselves, it says. And they use this as a substitute for the presence of Moses, but the way they talk about the thing, it is treated as a substitute for the presence of God, or as a symbol of the presence of God. And indeed, if you know anything about the, well, in Da Vinci Code, if you know anything about symbology, which, as far as I know, is a discipline that doesn't exist. If you know about symbols in the ancient Near East, you know that calves were a symbol of God's presence, only they weren't called calves, they were called cherubim. A cherub is a calf or a bull with wings and often with a few characteristics that are human in one way or another, and a figure like that was understood to be the throne of God. There were two of them on the Ark of the Covenant, which is the symbol of God's presence. So what they were really doing is making for themselves a symbol of the presence of God, since they had somehow lost track of Moses. And it's a very complicated story because there's a parallel story later on in the Deuteronomistic history by which the people condemned the worship practices of the northerners who had built sanctuaries for themselves when they got cut off from the sanctuary down in Jerusalem for political reasons. And I don't want to go into all of that, but the whole question at stake in the golden calf story is, where is God? And is God going on our journey with us or not? And so we have this terrible debacle then in Exodus 32 in which the people are punished. Actually, they're forgiven by God, but punished by Moses, who has talked God into forgiving them, which is another complication that we're not going to take time to try to unravel. But then after the golden calf thing is finally over with, God says to Moses, I'm not going with you anymore. It almost sounds like God is afraid to go with the people because he's afraid of the consequences of one more rebellious incident. He says, I'm afraid this is such a stiff-necked people, I might just nuke them in a moment of rage on the way up. So I'm just going to maybe send an angel along with you and not go up with you myself. And that makes the people mourn and very sorrowfully they take off all of the jewelry they have left, and they're in a state of pitiful mourning. And then we get this funny little history from the narrator about how God's presence used to be known among the people and what they deal with now. If you have a Bible and you want to look along at this, and it's in Exodus 33, verses 7 and following. When the people heard, I started at 4 by accident. People are in mourning because they heard this terrible news about God not going with them. And here's what used to happen. Verse 7, Moses used to take the tent, the tent of meeting apparently, and pitch it outside the camp, far off from the camp. He called it the tent of meeting, and everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. And whenever Moses went out to the tent of the all the people would rise and stand, and each of them at the entrance of their tent would watch Moses until he went in. And Moses entered the tent. The pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and Yahweh, the Lord, would speak with Moses. While all the people saw the pillar standing there, and the people would rise and bow down, and all of them at the entrance of their own tents. Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses, panim al panim is what it says in Hebrew, face to face, as one speaks to one's friend. And then he would come back to the camp, but his young assistant Joshua would stay there. So that's how it used to be. We used to know exactly where God was. God used to show up. Moses could go out there and talk to God at the appointed place, face to face, the way a man talks with his friend. Now it's going to be different. And God's not going to go with them. And so Moses says to the Lord then in verse 12, well, you've said bring this people up, but you haven't let me know who you're going to send with me. You said, I know you by name, you found favor in my sight. Well, if that's so, show me your ways so that I know for sure that I found favor in your sight. And you can begin to tell what Moses really wants. Moses just wants some assurance that this is all going to work. The question of whether or not God is with them isn't really about, you know, what are we going to talk about today, or what are we on today, or the question is this journey going to succeed? Are we going to make it to the land of promise? Are you still with us? So God says, my presence is with you, and I will give you rest. Moses says, if your presence isn't with us, we're not going. Don't take us any further. But how can we know that we found, that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people, unless you go with us? And this is all that makes us distinct, I and your people, from every place on the face of the earth. So that's also what's at stake, is their identity. So then you get this wonderful little strange moment. The Lord said to Moses, I'll do what you ask. For you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. Moses says, show me your glory. And he said, I'll make all my goodness pass by you. I will be gracious to whom I'll be gracious. That's why I'm the Lord. I'll show mercy on whom I'll show mercy. But you can't see my face. So here's what we'll do. There's a place by me where you can stand on a rock, and while my glory passes by, I'll put you in the cleft of the rock, and I'll cover you with my hand until I pass by, and then I'll take my hand away, like as soon as I'm past, and you can see my, the English Bible says back. I think some say backside. In Hebrew it's acharei, which does mean either the backside of something, the divine derriere. it's a strange word in some ways, in some context. It's the same word used back in Exodus 3, where Moses is when he first meets up with God at the burning bush. He's at the acharei of the wilderness, the backside of the wilderness, the really deepest part of the wilderness. But here, you can't see my face. Nobody can see my face and live. But you can see my back. Well, what kind of thing is that as a substitute for having an absolutely sure sign of the presence of God? I think this is a very profound teaching about how people know the presence of God, or at least a profound way that people know the presence of God. And here's my interpretation of this story, and I'll be glad to hear how some others of you make sense of this. To me, it seems that given what Moses wants to know, he wants to know, at least I believe, whether this journey is going to work. And so when he wants to see the face of God, he wants to be out in front of God, which is the only place, if God is on a journey, the only place where you can be, where you can see God's face. And God says, you can't get out front of me. You can't get into the future, Moses. The living don't get there. You don't get out in front of God. What you can see is where God has been. You can see the backside. You can be in the wake of God, behind God. And from there you can see, as God has said, I show mercy to whom I show mercy, and so forth. And so to me, this is a lesson in how theology works. Theology is God talk. It's the language by which we try to understand God, identify God, know God. I mean, obviously there are many other ways to know God, but theology is language about God. And what we do is we study whatever it is that we conceive of as being in the wake of God. You know, we study history. We look at the patterns. We try to discern the patterns in human experience, at least that's one way we do it. We discover where God has been, and from that we understand who God is and discern God's mercy and so forth.
Excuse me.
Yes.
A little early. If you take this literally. Factually, earlier God was speaking face to face with Moses, and now God is saying, "You can't see my face." How do we understand that?
Well, I don't know what it means to stand face to face with God if God is a spirit and if you can't see God and live. You know, I don't really know exactly what the ancients thought. I see Exodus 32 to 34 as a whole collection of texts about the presence of God and difficulties that people have had over the centuries of collecting this material with that very question. The golden calf story is really part of a big fight about whether God was truly present down south in Jerusalem with the southerners, or whether God was really up north with the northerners. I've said this before up here, it was a question of two synods. You know, down here where they had the green hymn books, they had the temple. And they had ripped off the Ark of the Covenant from the northerners, and the Ark of the Covenant was the great symbol of God's presence that had come out of the Exodus period. It was the throne of God, you know, and there's this wonderful story in 1 Samuel 4 to 6, and it's finished in 2 Samuel 6, about the Ark of the Covenant, how they used to keep it at Shiloh, and one time in this war against the Philistines, the thing got captured because they hauled it out to the battle, thinking that if they hauled it out to the battle, God, who was enthroned upon it, would save them from their enemies, and lo and behold, they lost. The thing got captured, and then the ark starts waging its own war against the Philistines, you know. That's a really funny story, the way it picks on the Philistines until they finally tie it to some milk cows and whack the cows on the butt, and the cows go running off into Israelite territory. You know, the ark is bumping along, and somebody tries to save it from this rough treatment and gets zapped, you know. So, man, this thing is dangerous. Finally, the bottom line is David later on gets away with moving the thing to Jerusalem. The point of being, you can't make God go anywhere. You can't haul God around to do your bidding. You can't have God in a box. But the fact that David got away with moving it down to Jerusalem, where he was going to set up a sanctuary, is a way to legitimate David. And David's making Jerusalem the central place, and ultimately the place where his son would build the temple for the ark and so forth. And so that's how Jerusalem, I mean, the ark is a part of a story that legitimates making Jerusalem the central place of God's presence. Okay, so you have to go there to worship. So now the kingdom splits. The northern kingdom, they want to know, First Kings 13 says that Jeroboam, who was now the new leader of the northern kingdom, says, what am I going to do? If I don't have a place for people to worship up here in the north, they're all going to keep going back down to Jerusalem to worship, and I'll lose them. So what does he do? First Kings says he committed a terrible apostasy. He built two golden calves, and he put one in Bethel and one in Dan, and told the people to worship calves as God. Now, I ask you, if you were part of a congregation that had a big fight and it split, and the other faction besides your faction, got the church building, and your group was finally out on your own, what would you do? Would it occur to any of you, to say, oh my God, we've lost our church building. I've got it, let's worship cows! Would you do that?
There's some people in our church who might.
But that's what 1 Kings accuses Jeroboam of doing. Saying, oh my God, we lost the temple, let's worship cows. I mean, that's stupid. What he did was he built a cherubim in Bethel, which is on the far southern end of the northern kingdom, and another one in Dan, which is at the far northern end of the northern kingdom. So now he's got a cherubim on either end of his kingdom. His kingdom now looks just like the Ark of the Covenant, which the southerners had ripped off from the northerners. It's a way to say, they think they got God in a box. Our whole country is the throne of God. God is with us. That's what really happened. But you know who wrote the story? The southerners wrote the story. And winners always get to write history. And they always say, yeah, those guys worship cows. You know, they aren't like us. So that's what's really going on. It was really a big fight about which synod had God. These Israelites or these Israelites? Both of them claiming to be the faithful people of God, the followers of the tradition. And of course they both screwed it all up. Baal worship and all kinds of craziness in addition. But, you know, the question was really, with whom is God? That's a part of what's going on here.
Wasn't Baal kind of a cow-like creature too or something?
Well, all the ancient peoples used animals as symbols of the presence of God. Sure, the whole business of cherubim was in, I mean, they had that symbol in common with Canaanites as well, sure. Yeah, the Canaanites had Baal and Asherah, and so they had animal symbols as well as poles and hills and all kinds of things were symbols of God's presence, or the symbols of the presence of their gods. As far as the tent of meeting, that There's a lot of theories about that, but it, you know, the sort of prevailing theory is that it's a piece of the tradition connected sort of more with the certain priestly and prophetic circles, that there was a time that they imagined in the ancient past where people did actually, Moses could actually consult with God. You know, and it's kind of way back there. I mean, even this story is presented as though that's a once upon a time kind of thing, but now we got to only look at God's backside. You know, and I think every culture does that. I mean, think about the United States. We don't do it with God in a direct way in our culture because we have separation of church and state. But if you listen to the way people talk about the founding fathers and the writers of the Constitution, they act as though those people who wrote the Constitution were a whole different kind of human being who had access to divine knowledge about politics. And now we got to sit around all this time later and try to discern what their divine insight was. And do strict constructionism. I mean, it's really a kind of a fundamentalist version of religio-politics. You know, to assume that there once was a race of people that was totally face-to-face with God. And now we poor blighters have to live in ignorance, discerning their great wisdom. You know. When probably, if you, at least this is my opinion, you know, all any of us have ever done is look at the backside and try to figure out what in the world was happening. You know, which leads me to my story, because I do want to get to Mark, and we're already halfway through this period. I shared this last week. Today, the great symbol of God's presence that I keep being reintroduced to over and over and over again, as I'm sure you are too, is the what some people believe is the divinely inspired poem about the footprints in the sand. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm being silly now. Not that you didn't notice. But you know the thing about, where were you, God? I see two sets of footprints in the sand, and then there's a whole stretch where there's only one, and God says, oh, that's when I was carrying you. Well, I'll give you an alternative if you're as weary of that one as I am. And this one comes from the territory of where I spent the earliest part of my life in open range country in west central Wyoming. And I didn't actually do this myself because I was too young, but I learned about this thing that people used to do when they did a roundup of the young steers to bring them in so that they wouldn't die of the elements, and they would then gather them in and ship them off to be feeder cattle somewhere. Every once in a while there would be a steer that just resisted being brought in the roundup, and you could just forget about them and figure, well, if sort of unlike that crazy shepherd in the Bible who we'll talk about later this week, we can't abide the loss of even one of the flock or the herd. Well, sometimes they would just say, well, you know,
good luck.
99.4% is pretty good. You just have to give up on a few. But there was a trick that some ranchers used. They would take a healthy, sturdy old donkey and in a truck out to where the steer was. And these steers were often, you know, approachable. They just wouldn't move. They wouldn't come with you. So they would take the donkey out there with a long rope. I don't know how long the rope was. But anyway, they had a harness attached to either end of the rope. And they would then simply fix one harness on the steer and one harness on the donkey and leave. And about 3 days later, they would both show up back at the home place. And the reason is because of the nature of donkeys. If you know anything about donkeys, donkeys will go home. A donkey will always, and it's kind of like a home except big. And really, really stubborn. And they will go to the place where they were fed, period. They will get there, unless you shoot them. So, a couple days later, here would come the donkey and the steer, and they would both be pretty bloodied and scraped up, but they'd be home, and eventually they'd be fine. And the steer would be rounded up. And so, as an alternative to these footprints in the sand, I offer you, and I think this is more the picture of my life than those footprints, you know, a set of faithful donkey tracks and a lot of skid marks. That's the story of the presence of God. So, all right.
And who's dragging who again?
Well, in my little analogy, I think, you know, the God or the Christ figure is the faithful donkey, and I'm the one making the skid marks. Saying, I'm not going there! You can't make me!
Although it's neat that Moses is kind of the one pulling God along in this portion.
Well, yeah.
That's what's really, I mean, remarkable about all this dialogue with God.
Yeah. That's another thing we could do here, is to discuss the advocacy relationship and the intermediary relationship that Moses has. And, you know, one of the reasons that Moses gets the reputation in the Pentateuch for being the, you know, the alternative presence of God is the fact that Moses is presented as this one who could change God's mind, among other things, you know, and at certain points, God says, you know, I was going to do something, but then I remembered I didn't tell Moses, so I got to tell Moses first, then I can proceed. So, I mean, this is an amazing special position that Moses has. And it's one of the reasons why everyone later on covets the place of Moses, because anyone, of course, would want to have such a type of authority. Well, all this will be on the test on Friday, but we're moving on. Unless there are other comments or questions, we'll take a quick look at Mark's gospel this morning and try to discern its theology of presence. Just a little bit of background about Mark and the study of Mark. The early church, earlier centuries of the Christian church, have treated Mark as a kind of defective gospel. It was thought for a long time to sort of be the Reader's Digest condensed version of Matthew. Matthew was thought to have been the sort of Ur-Gospel, the original Gospel, although some people thought John might have had that position as well. And then Luke was writing for Gentiles and had changed some things and written an alternative version of Matthew, but Mark, for whatever reason, had written the apocryphated version, shortened version. And it was kind of ignored in the ancient lectionary traditions. I mean, if you grew up, as I did, in one of the old one-year lectionary systems, 80% of the readings were from Matthew or John. And we added a bit of Luke so that we could still have the Good Samaritan and the Prodigal Son and a few of those great parables. In there, we used Luke at Christmas, of course, because we just love the shepherds and the wise men and so forth. But where was Mark? There wasn't hardly anything in Mark that we needed that we didn't have elsewhere, so Mark just got ignored in the old lexicon system. But in more recent times, in the last couple hundred years, well, in the larger scheme of things, the scholarly world has more or less decided that Mark the prevailing hypothesis is that Mark is the oldest of the canonical Gospels, and that Matthew and Luke expanded on Mark, and John is out there in a different category. I personally think John knew all these Gospels and responded to all of them. Don't need to go into that. So we have Mark here, which still, no matter when you think it comes, first or later on, is missing some things, and it's a kind of a curious document, especially when you're used to the rest of the Gospels. For one thing, if you turn to Mark, you notice, and I'm sure most of you have studied this, and this is old stuff to you, but Mark begins after only a few verses about John the Baptist with an adult Jesus who shows up to be baptized by John at the Jordan River, and we have no information whatsoever about his Jesus background, where he comes from, except that he's from Nazareth in Galilee, and you know, nothing about his birth, nothing about his early life, what he did, who his people are, nothing. I mean, I like to joke with my students about the ultimate damage done to the entire world if the only gospel we had was Mark. I mean, 15% of the gross national product of the United States alone down the tubes because no Christmas. No huge spending orgy in, well, we started now the day after Halloween. The Kmart starts playing the music. But no Christmas, no birth, you know. And then at the other end, of course, you have this strange apocryphated ending as well. And this is where things really come now to be a critical matter for a bunch of people sitting around pondering, I am with you always. At the end of the book, Jesus is crucified, and the women come out to the tomb on the first day of the week when Sabbath is passed to take care of some burial matters that hadn't yet been finished, and what do they find there but an empty tomb and a fellow sitting there saying, well, he's not here. He went to Galilee just like he promised you he would, so you better go up there if you want to see him. And they run away afraid and say nothing to anyone. And that's it. Well, what kind of gospel is that? No appearance stories. I mean, there are several alternative endings to Mark, you know. Some of them are even printed in the Bibles that you're looking at, probably. Yep. Either in brackets or italics or footnotes or something indicate to you that verses 9 to 20 are an alternative longer ending that was added, scholars now think, midway through the 2nd century, at a time when there were all sorts of fights about authenticating the faith through snake handling and poison handling and all sorts of other things. There are alternative shorter endings and so forth, but the manuscript, the agreed upon manuscript tradition ends with those women running away afraid, saying nothing to anyone, and actually, again, the scholarly community pretty much assumes that's the original ending. Well, what kind of way is that to end the book? So Mark is thought to be sort of this flawed document. If we had about a week just to do Mark, we could see that it's actually a really remarkable and whole and complete literary structure. We can kind of do a hit-and-run version of that today. And I'll do a quick overview so that I can show you why I think Mark's gospel is written for people that were asking the question that I asked with Elie Wiesel yesterday, where is God now? In the Gospel of Mark, you have this fellow who gets baptized, and his baptism is much more private than it is, for example, in Matthew. In Matthew's gospel, a voice from heaven announces in third-person pronouns, "This is my beloved son," and so forth. But in Mark, the voice speaks in second-person singular pronouns straight to Jesus, "You are my son." And Jesus is the one who sees the heavens open. In Matthew, they're just open. But this is an experience of some kind that Jesus is having about who he is. And from that point on, he then begins to hide the identity that was revealed to him there when the heavens opened. And demon-possessed individuals keep trying to expose him. You know, some verses later, he gets in conversation with a demon-possessed person who says, "I know who you are, the Holy One of God." And he silences that person, shuts him down, and he just keeps doing that. Every time anybody gets close to this Son of God thing, man, he shuts that down right away. He's hiding that identity that's connected to his baptism. And that theme goes on. I mean, the other Gospels pick that up a little bit, but this is basically Mark's thing. This secret Jesus who hides that identity of his baptism until halfway through the Gospel, if you were here the other night in the sermon, at the Eucharist, you heard me talk about this in the sermon, the way he starts in chapter 8 then to come plainly out, at least with the disciples, and say, "Here's the deal, guys, I'm going up to Jerusalem to die." Chapter 9, "I'm going up to Jerusalem to die." Chapter 10, "I'm going up to Jerusalem to die." Do you get it yet? And then he goes up to Jerusalem and dies. And in the story, the way Mark tells the passion of Jesus, every piece of it makes Jesus look exactly like an audience that gets baptized in secret, has to hide their identity, but when caught, is shown some advice about how to endure this experience of going through martyrdom. And so, you know, some people put Mark somewhere in Asia Minor, among perhaps Gentile Christians going through at least somewhat difficult times in the 70s, perhaps, or the 80s. I'm among people who believe that Mark was written specifically for people going through the persecutions of the Neronic Empire. After Rome burned in 64 and Nero blamed this on the Christians, there were vicious but sporadic persecutions for a while in and around Rome. And for the first time, Christians were persecuted specifically as Christians and not just because most of them were Jews. And the Romans hated Jews and were always picking on Jews. But now the Christians, as Christians, were facing it. And I believe Mark was writing for them. And they're asking, "Where is God?" But they're also asking, "Where is the risen Christ? And what is he doing?" Part of the story of Mark is going through yourself, the absence of God as one who's going through suffering and persecution. And of course, Jesus himself experiences the absence of everyone. Jesus is abandoned by everyone in Mark's gospel. Abandoned by his friends, abandoned by his own people, the Jews, who hand him over to the Romans. Then he's abandoned and mistreated by the vaunted Roman legal system. Everyone fails God. Everyone fails Jesus. And even at the end, he cries out praying, my God, why you too? Why have you abandoned me?" So the presence of God is a problem even for Jesus in this gospel. So this gospel is a huge cry, "Where is God?" And then we get it, then we get to the end, and we got an absent Jesus to you. At the end of Mark, unlike all the other Gospels, we don't get to see Jesus. You get to the end of Mark, and he is gone. So here are the early Christians. You know, it's one thing to cope with the absence of God, but now the absence of our Lord Jesus as well. All we have is this word from this crazy messenger at the tomb. Well, he went to Galilee. Oh. What kind of answer is that? So, how does the Gospel of Mark answer the question, where is the risen Christ and what is he doing? The other Gospels have ways, I'll talk about these the whole rest of the week. You know, Luke's Gospel does it with that amazing Emmaus story. Jesus can be right on the road with you and you don't recognize him, but here's what happens that allows you to recognize him. Matthew, Jesus shows up and says, okay guys, here's the deal, I am with you always. John's got two chapters worth of that kind of stuff. But Mark, he just vanishes. So what are we supposed to think as the readers of Mark? Where is the risen Christ and what is he doing? We have 12 minutes. We still want to have at least some time for discussion and questions. There is one story in Mark's Gospel that specifically has this directive to it. Don't tell this one now. Tell it when the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. That's the moment to tell this story, which is the Transfiguration story. Mark 9, 2-9, almost right smack in the middle of the Gospel. The Transfiguration story happens on the mountain. And what do we witness there? Jesus is with
Moses and Elijah.
Okay. Jesus is with Moses and Elijah. We get this interesting scene in which Peter, in all the Gospels or in the synoptics that tell this story, tries to institutionalize this somehow or another. You know, let's build something up here to sort of capture this thing. But it can't. We can't stay here. We have to go down. That's part of all of them. But Jesus appears in dazzling clothes with Moses and Elijah. But don't tell anybody about this till the Son of Man is raised from the dead. And then say, we've seen Jesus. Moses and Elijah. Well, what good is that? How does that help you after the resurrection of Jesus? Well, I actually didn't mean that rhetorically, but I'll answer my own question. Elijah's the easier one. Because, you know, Jesus cries out, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, and two of the Gospels say that people thought Jesus was calling for Elijah. Because people did. People in extremity apparently called out for Elijah. And there are lots of pieces of Jewish tradition that suggest that Elijah was still about. He had been taken straight to be with God. You remember back in the Deuteronomistic history, that's a funny story too. Elijah gets fed up with his job and pulls the old I quit trick on God, thinking that God will say, oh, all right, I'll take care of some things for you. And God says, fine, hand over your stuff and meet me outside of town. And here comes the sweet low swinging chariot, and Elijah's gone. That's the end of that little game. But in any case, Elijah is with God. And in Jewish tradition, he was believed to be sort of like the patron saint of hopeless causes. He could show up to aid the distressed and the endangered and so forth. And to this day, the door is left open a crack and a place set at Passover in case Elijah comes. Moses is another matter. Where's Moses? What's the Bible say about where is Moses? What?
Just outside the promised land.
Moses dies at the end of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy chapter 34. Yeah, God takes Moses up to the mountain because he did the little rock slap thing. And he doesn't get to go into the promised land. And God says, you can see it, but you can't go. And we read then at the end of Deuteronomy 34, Moses died there. And God buried Moses. And no one knows the place of the tomb to this day. Says Deuteronomy. Well, in between the writing of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, a whole bunch of books got written, many of them addressing situations of persecution in the Hellenistic period and so forth. And among the books that got written that appear among books now called Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, as non-canonical books that were important to Jewish people but didn't make the canon. There's a book called The Assumption of Moses, which says that the archangel wrested the body of Moses at the moment of his dying from Satan and took Moses to heaven to be with God. So that Moses isn't really buried either up there on that mountain, as Deuteronomy says, but Moses, like Elijah, is also with God. And we know that at least some early Christians found that book useful and credible because the book of Jude quotes it with approval. And the book of Jude almost didn't make it into the New Testament canon because of its use of the Assumption of Moses, which was not considered an authoritative book by others. And but anyway, that set of connections allows us to see that there were early Christians who thought of Moses also as not dead but with God. And so a story told among early Christians that Jesus had once been seen with Moses and Elijah is to put Jesus in the company of two great individuals in the tradition who are not only with God, but available to be dispatched by God on missions of aid to God's people. Moses was sent to help people study in the Jewish tradition. Elijah sent to aid people in trouble. So where is Jesus and what is he doing? Well, he's been seen with Moses and Elijah. In fact, in such a way that he appears to even to take over those roles of the ancient law and the prophets. That's who Moses and Elijah stand for, is the law and the prophets. And so Jesus now is with God, and he is available to the community as the teacher, as the aid. His presence is still with the community. That's one way. That's one way that you can understand an answer in Mark to the question, where is the risen Christ and what is he doing? It's not that far from what the other Gospels do when they talk about Jesus' ascension. I'll get into those later. But the other way, another way to do this is to follow a clue that, I don't know who started this notion, but I first learned it from one of Gordon Lathrop's books. Gordon Lathrop is a scholar of the liturgy, but he's pretty astute on the scriptures as well. And he suggests that what you do when you get to the end of Mark, and that young man there says, well, if he's not here, you got to go to Galilee if you want to see him. Okay, how do you do that? Especially if you're Mark's readers. How do you go to Galilee? Well, remember, the book started in Galilee. So Lathrop says, this is the clue that what you're supposed to do is now reread Mark. Only reread Mark looking for the risen Christ. And lo and behold, if you do that, you find him. And you find him not only at the Transfiguration, you find him all over the place. You can find him, for example, in this coming Sunday's Gospel lesson in a very interesting way. Let's turn to that for just a moment. Mark 4. Verses 35 and following. On that day when evening had come, Jesus said to them, let's go to the other side. And leaving the crowd behind, they took him with them in the boat just as he was. Other boats were with him. A great windstorm arose and the waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already swamped. But he was in the stern asleep on the cushion, and they woke him and said, teacher, don't you care if we perish? He woke up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, peace, be still. The wind ceased. There was a dead calm. He said to them, why are you afraid? Are you still have no faith? They were filled with awe, said to one another, who is this that even the wind and sea obey him? Now, first time through, you know, that's a story about how dumb the disciples were. No matter what they witnessed, all they could do is say, holy cow, who was that? The disciples just don't get it in Mark's gospel. But now we're going back through and we're looking for the risen Christ. And what do we see here? We see Jesus' disciples tossed on a stormy sea. And a boat, of course, was a favorite image for the church. Beginning perhaps with those stories of the boat from which you cast the net and haul God's great dragnet of the gospel through the world, trying to collect all you can to come into the boat. We still call church a nave, right? Which is ship. And where is Jesus? He's sleeping in the cushion in the stern. Any of you sailors? You know what's supposed to happen on the cushion in the stern?
Steer the boat.
Pardon?
Steer the boat.
Yeah, that's where you steer the boat. Jesus is asleep at the wheel. This was the experience of the early church. Tossed on the stormy seas of life, and where is our risen Lord? Well, he's sleeping. We better wake him up. It wasn't the first time the faithful had to do that. We're supposed to remember here all kinds of stories, including Jonah. You know, there's hints of the Jonah story here, but there's also hints of the time in Isaiah 51. They got to scream at God, wake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Don't you see that we're perishing? So the absence of Christ in the early Christian community is addressed with prayer, and Christ, the risen Christ, awakens, and it's metaphorical language of some kind, obviously, but the risen Christ is there with you and gets you through the journey. That's a way to look at this story. And if you go on and on through the rest of the sequence of stories after this point, you find Jesus in all sorts of contexts that we also know. He invades the land of the Gadarene demoniac and comes into the territory of people like us who live among the tombs. You know, we are in the land of uncleanness and death. And Jesus invades our death-bound territory. And instead of him ending up unclean and dead, we come out alive. And so on and so on and so on. Jesus keeps invading the land of uncleanness and death. The risen Christ comes into our lives. So that's where we see the risen Christ, and that's what he's doing. At least by that reading of Mark's Gospel. And it's now 10 seconds after 10 o'clock, and I left no time for questions. I sincerely apologize. We can start with questions about Mark tomorrow, and then we'll go on to Luke. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.